Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. New Hampshire voters head to the polls Tuesday for the presidential primary. Candidates on both sides of the aisle debated in New Hampshire, and we'll have some highlights for you today. Locally, East County's Congressman Duncan Hunter has introduced a bill that would make young women register for the draft. And State Senator Ben Wesso is being sued for campaign finance violations, and it's not the first time. We'll have details on both of these stories today. Be on the lookout for a stolen backhoe from an East County construction site. Stay tuned for a description. The sheriff is rolling out testing of body cameras starting this past Friday, and part of East County is included, so if you're pulled over, smile, you may be on candid camera. We'll have a story today of a dramatic rescue with a bittersweet ending after a hiker and a horse plunged over 200 feet off a trail in our local mountains. Then from La Mesa, here's some news for dog owners to howl about. The city council has voted to increase the number of dogs you're allowed to own. The state conducted a sting in San Diego County that busted contractors operating without a license. Stay tuned to learn how to protect yourself from scamsters seeking to prey on homeowners in need of repairs or other improvements. The state's largest medical association has gone to pot, announcing its approval of a recreational marijuana initiative, and we'll tell you why on today's show. Then on our Capitol Report, hear why President Obama's nomination to head up the Food and Drug Administration is stirring up controversy, and who's standing up to try and block the confirmation. Valentine's Day is next weekend, and we'll have a heartwarming tale for you about a very special Valentine's Day at the Oasis Camel Dairy, where a fast-thinking rancher saved a young animal born during a blizzard. And we'll tell you about an upcoming open house for animal lovers this Valentine's weekend. From Public News Service, hear about a proposed ballot initiative that would extend a tax on the wealthy for funding public education. On the second half of our show today, we'll replay our Tribal Beat interview with geologist Nori Robbins talking about hydrology, and our bookshelf interview with New York Times winning author and true crimes writer Caitlin Rother on her new book, Then No One Can Have Her. Next up, if you're looking for some steals on wheels, we'll tell you about the county's vehicle auction this week, where you can shop for bargains on everything from cars and SUVs to school buses. Finally, on Green Scene, learn why environmentalists are cheering the defeat of a bill on national monuments in the Senate. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Democrats and Republicans each held debates among their presidential candidates in New Hampshire in recent days. The Democratic debate was the first to feature a head-to-head direct matchup between Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton after Massachusetts Governor Martin O'Malley dropped out. Sanders hammered on his theme of addressing the wealth gap in America and faulted Clinton for her Wall Street ties and vote for the Iraq War, which he opposed. He said, "There's a reason why these people are putting huge amounts of money into our political system. In my view, it is undermining American democracy and allowing Congress to represent wealthy campaign contributors and not the working families," he said of Wall Street and the Koch brothers. Clinton touted her foreign policy experience and accused Sanders of an artful smear for her acceptance of hefty campaign donations and speaking fees from Wall Street. She claimed, "You will not find that I ever changed a view or a vote because of any donation I ever received." She then defined a progressive as, quote, "someone who makes progress," unquote. Prior to the Republican debate, several candidates announced their withdrawal from the race or suspension of candidacy, including Rand Paul, Rick Santorum, and Mike Huckabee. During the debate, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie took aim at Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who placed third in the Iowa Republican caucus after Senator Ted Cruz and billionaire businessman Donald Trump. Christie slammed Rubio for repeating himself during the debate, stating, "The memorized 30-second speech where you talk about how great America is at the end of it doesn't solve one problem for one person." He also criticized Rubio's D-minus record for attendance in the Senate, saying, "That's not leadership, that's truancy." Ohio Governor John Kasich has moved up in the polls since departure of several other candidates. During the debate, he laid out what he called a practical approach to immigration, claiming he would take a compassionate view of conservatism and work across party lines to break gridlock in Congress, insisting, "We can do it." Trump, the frontrunner in New Hampshire polls, drew boos after Florida Governor Jeb Bush attacked Trump for trying to take land through an eminent domain process for a private business venture. Though Trump has positioned himself as a tough leader, Bush fired back, "How tough is it to take property from an elderly lady?" Both Trump and Cruz voiced support for bringing back waterboarding, which they denied is torture, and Trump said that he would go even further than waterboarding. Neurosurgeon Ben Carson blasted Senator Ted Cruz after revelations that the Cruz campaign falsely told Iowa delegates that Carson had dropped out of the race. Cruz apologized, claiming he knew nothing about this, and blamed a CNN report. CNN later said Cruz described their report inaccurately and released video to prove it. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Congressman Duncan Hunter has introduced the Draft America's Daughters Act, a bill that would require young women to register for the draft. Hunter, a Republican representing East County, doesn't really want to see women drafted. He says he introduced the measure along with Congressman Ryan Zinke of Montana as a protest measure against the Obama administration's decision to open combat roles to women in the military. The U.S. military is currently comprised of all volunteer forces, but young men are required to register with the Selective Service when they turn 18 in case a draft is revived. Hunter's bill would require young women ages 18 to 26 to also register. According to the Washington Post, Hunter said, "If this administration wants to send 18 to 20-year-old women into combat to serve and fight on the front lines, then the American people deserve to have this discussion through their elected representatives." Last week, Army Chief of Staff Mark Milley and Marine Commandant General Robert Neller testified before the Senate that they believe there should no longer be an exemption in the draft for half the country's population now that the military is inclusive of women in combat. Ironically, Hunter, a former Marine, has said he would probably vote against his own proposal if it actually comes up for a vote. The proposal to draft women raises some troubling issues, since women can face special risks beyond those confronting men in the military. Polls show that a majority of Americans now say they would support having women register for the draft, but they may not be aware of the special risks associated with such service for women. The Los Angeles Times reports that recent studies by the Department of Defense and Veterans Affairs found that 23% of women in the military experienced sexual assault and 10% of military women reported that they had been raped. Women veterans also commit suicide 6 times more often than men who are veterans. Additionally, chemicals that American troops have been exposed to in past wars were found to cause birth defects in their children. Pregnant women in the military who received the anthrax vaccine also had higher rates of children born with birth defects. Should all women be forced to take this risk solely because some military women volunteered to do so? Should equality of opportunity mandate equal responsibility for all, regardless of risks involved? Or should protecting a generation of children not yet born factor into the equation? These are tough questions, and Hunter's provocative bill raises the opportunity for discussion on these important issues. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Richard Faust.
State Senator Ben Hueso, a San Diego Democrat, and his campaign treasurer Nancy Haley are being sued by activist Ken Moser and retired Marine Colonel Richard Sigley for allegedly failing to properly disclose campaign expenditures. Moser and Sigley contend that the defendant also committed perjury. The action is the latest in a string of controversies involving Hueso's campaign finances. The lawsuit filed on January 11th comes on the heels of a similar complaint filed with the Fair Political Practices Commission late last year, alleging that Hueso failed to disclose roughly $74,000 in expenditures. The bulk of those were legal fees for his defense in another case, which were listed as office expenses instead of a separate category for legal costs. Hueso's attorney, in a legal pleading in another case slated for trial this month, stated that over $65,000 in legal fees were inadvertently omitted from the legal report. An earlier suit in 2009 also alleged failure to properly report legal fees. These two cases will now be consolidated per an order by Judge Catherine Bacall. The plaintiff seeks more than $85,000 in civil penalties plus attorney fees. Hueso, who is on probation for driving under the influence in Sacramento, California, was reelected months later in the fall of 2014. The senator has a history of campaign violations in prior campaigns. In 2005, he paid a $10,750 fine to settle violations of failing to report legal defense fees while running for San Diego Unified School Board. In 2006, he paid a $17,000 fine to the San Diego Ethics Commission for taking contributions over the legal limit while running for the San Diego City Council. While running for the State Assembly in 2010, he paid a $2,000 fine to the California Fair Political Practices Commission for funneling some of his campaign funds into his brother's city council campaign. He also received a warning from the FPPC for failing to disclose non-monetary donations. Hueso's district spans the southern portion of San Diego County from Chula Vista to Jacumba, as well as part of Riverside County and all of Imperial County. He chairs the State Senate's Energy, Utilities, and Communications Committee and serves as vice chair on the Veterans Committee, also chairing a select committee on California-Mexico cooperation. Hueso has served in the legislature since 2010. Last year, his legislation included SB 660, a measure vetoed by Governor Jerry Brown that would have prohibited backroom communications between the California Public Utilities officials and the utilities they regulate. A measure to require cardiac defibrillators in new large buildings was signed by the governor, as was a bill aimed at boosting voter turnout by consolidating elections in areas with low turnout. In 2016, bills introduced by Senator Hueso include the Equal Gender Pricing Bill, which would prohibit vendors from charging higher prices for the same or similar products based on gender. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
This is Tasha Matthews with a Crime Beat Report. The sheriff and Crime Stoppers are asking the public's help to identify suspects who stole a construction backhoe loader and tools from the front yard of a home undergoing construction in Jacuma Hot Springs back on December 14th. A $1,000 reward is being offered for information leading to an arrest. The JCB backhoe is worth about $30,000, and detectives suspect a tow truck may have been used to haul it away. It is yellow and has a cracked windshield. Thieves also took about $5,000 worth of tools from the home in the 43,000 block of Old Highway 80. Anyone with information on this case should call the Boulevard Sheriff's Office at 619-766-4585 or the Crime Stoppers Anonymous tip line at 888-580-8477. Anonymous email and text messages can be sent via sdcrimestoppers.org.
Sheriff Bill Gore has announced that his department will launch a pilot program to test body cameras. The test period starts Friday, February 5th. It includes the Lakeside Substation, Rancho San Diego Station, and Rural Command covering much of East County as well as the North Coastal and Vista Stations, plus deputies assigned to the Hall of Justice. The testing will use cameras provided by WatchGuard Video, Taser International, and ViaVu. Each company's products will be tested for 30 days during a 90-day test period overall. The Sheriff's Department set up a committee that has been exploring the suitability and feasibility of body cameras for deputies since August 2014. During the past 18 months, the committee met with other law enforcement agencies to discuss their experiences with body-worn cameras. Those agencies include the San Diego, Escondido, Chula Vista, and Carlsbad Police Departments, as well as the Los Angeles Police Department, LA County Sheriff's Department, and Mesa, Arizona Police Department. A Citizens Law Enforcement Review Board has also been consulted. The Citizens Board made several recommendations, notably asking deputies not be allowed to review body camera videotape before writing up their reports. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
A woman was rescued Wednesday after falling over 200 feet into a canyon in the Laguna Mountains, but her companion's horse died after rescuers were unable to save the frightened and injured animal. The Union Tribune reports that the horse slipped near the Quaimai Point Overlook off Sunrise Highway in East County. The rider jumped off to avoid injury. The man's girlfriend, riding nearby on the Pacific Crest Trail, grabbed the horse's bridle but was pulled over the edge of the precipice. both landed on a 6-foot ledge 260 feet down. The woman was hoisted out by helicopter after dark. A veterinarian sedated the horse, which was tethered and left on the ledge overnight. Next morning, rescuers spent 6 hours trying to save the horse, which fought efforts to put a hoist harness around it and injured 2 rescuers in the struggle. A painful decision was made to euthanize the horse. However, a veterinarian arrived to find the animal laying down on the ledge, and it died before the procedure could be done. Steve McKinnon, chief humane law enforcement officer with the San Diego Humane Society, speculated that the animal may have suffered internal injuries from the fall. He said, "We did everything we could." The horse had been saved 6 years ago by its owner from a horse rescue organization. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
La Mesa is going to the dogs. Last week, the city council voted to allow La Mesa residents to keep up to 5 dogs per household. The prior limit was just 2 dogs per home. The ordinance change was proposed by Councilwoman Christine Alicio, who hopes to encourage La Mesa residents to adopt more dogs from local shelters and animal rescue groups. The new law makes La Mesa more dog-friendly than other East County cities. El Cajon allows 3 dogs with a permit, while Lemon Grove and Santee each allow 4 dogs. The city of San Diego, however, allows up to 6 dogs per household. The vote was 4-1, with Councilwoman Ruth Sterling opposed. Sterling wanted to see lot sizes taken into consideration, with a maximum of 3 dogs. Some opponents, though, voiced concerns that barking dogs might annoy neighbors, though La Mesa's police chief and city attorney both indicated that any such complaints could be handled under the city's current noise ordinances. Supporters, on the other hand, applauded the new law as a doggone good measure. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Richard Faust.
Forecasters have been warning West Coast residents to prepare for heavy rains and flooding from this season's El Nino. But a sting operation conducted by the Contractors State License Board in San Diego in January found a flood of unlicensed workers advertising roof repairs and flood prevention jobs. The 2-day sting caught 15 unlicensed contractors. Here's how they got busted. On January 26th and 27th, investigators with the agency's statewide investigative fraud team invited suspects to a home in Tierra Santa to place bids for home improvement projects that included replacing a leaking garage roof, new concrete with drains to prevent flooding, wooden fence replacement, and non-storm jobs too, such as flooring and ornamental metal railings. Investigators used leads from Craigslist, local newspaper ads, and previous complaints to target suspected unlicensed contractors. The bogus contractors nabbed in the sting included San Diego and East County operators. Investigators found a few suspects who didn't learn from their previous mistakes. 3 of them were cited during prior stings on illegal contracting charges. With help from the San Diego District Attorney's Office and the California Highway Patrol officers, investigators found that 1 suspect caught during the sting operation had active arrest warrants in several states, and he's even on Florida law enforcement's most wanted list. He admitted to taking $9,700 for a job that he never even started. Each suspect caught in the sting operation was given a misdemeanor citation for contracting without a license after placing bids ranging from $1,200 to $9,000. A state contractor license is required for any bid that's $500 or more for total cost of labor and material. 12 suspects were also cited for a misdemeanor charge of illegal advertising. State law requires unlicensed contractors to state in all ads that they are not licensed. 1 of the 15 suspects was also given a citation for charging an excessive down payment. A down payment for home improvement projects cannot be over 10% of the total contract price or $1,000, whichever is less under California law. The Contractor's State License Board urges consumers to take the time to check out a contractor's license and make sure he or she is qualified for the type of home improvement job you're looking to have done. You can get this information free at the Contractor's State License Board website at cslb.ca.gov. You can also call the agency's toll-free automated line at 800-321-CSLB. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Legalize marijuana. That's what the California Medical Association wants to do. The largest professional association of doctors in our state has announced its support for a ballot initiative to legalize recreational marijuana use. The measure is called the Control, Regulate, and Tax Adult Use of Marijuana Act. But the doctors group emphasized that it does not endorse marijuana use and discourages smoking. The California Medical Association represents 41,000 physicians in California and has supported legalization for the past 5 years in order to enable more clinical research on the medical benefits of cannabis. A press release issued by the medical group states that its members believe that the most effective way to protect the public health is to, quote, tightly control, track, and regulate marijuana and to comprehensively research and educate the public on its health impacts, not through ineffective prohibition. Signature gatherers are currently working to qualify the initiative for the November ballot. Dr. Steve Larson, president of the California Medical Association, says that the measure offers a, quote, comprehensive and thoughtfully constructed measure that will allow state officials to better protect public health by clarifying the role of physicians, controlling and regulating marijuana use by responsible adults, and keeping it out of the hands of children, unquote. Larson says the Doctors Association wants to see medical marijuana regulated like medicine to assure safe and appropriate use by patients with legitimate health conditions, but believes that recreational use of marijuana by adults should be regulated like alcohol. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Tasha Matthews with the Capitol Report. A battle is looming on Capitol Hill over who will be the next commissioner of the United States Food and Drug Administration, or FDA. President Barack Obama has nominated Dr. Robert Califf, but the New York Times asserts that Dr. Califf has deeper ties to the pharmaceutical industry than any FDA commissioner in recent memory. At Duke University, he led a clinical research center that received most of its funding from drug companies. As recently as last year, he has acted as a consultant for several drug and medicine device manufacturers, raising questions over whether he could be an objective guardian of the public health. His nomination has cleared a key committee, so the next step is a vote in the full Senate. Several prominent Democratic senators have announced they will oppose the nomination, including presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. Citizens for Health has launched a petition asking senators to oppose Dr. Califf's nomination. This is not the first controversial appointment Obama has made at the FDA. In 2009, he named Michael Taylor, a former Monsanto vice president, as deputy FDA commissioner of foods, drawing outrage from consumer groups.
Valentine's Day has special meaning for Gil and Nancy Riegler, owners of the Oasis Camel Dairy in Ramona. That's because on Valentine's night, back in 2008, Gil found a newborn camel that had been abandoned by its mother, who got confused during a snowstorm. The baby camel was frozen, her legs and neck completely stiff, but Gil didn't give up. He scooped up the baby camel in his arms and rushed into the house, awakening Nancy as he filled a bathtub with warm water. Together, they spent 45 minutes warming up the tiny calf and rubbing her until, miraculously, she began to gurgle, then breathe, and finally move her little limbs. The couple took the young camel into their garage and spent the next 2.5 hours warming her with blow dryers and rubbing her with towels. Soon the calf was able to drink a warm pint of milk from a bottle. Gil and Nancy slept beside the newborn all night and gave her an appropriate name. Nancy says Valentine's Day will always be very special here at the dairy, as this was when our beloved Valentine was born in the snow. Valentine was one of several calves born that first February at the Camel Dairy. Some of the other births also proved challenging, but all of the babies and each of the mother camels survived and thrived. Nancy observes, February is all about love at the dairy. This year, two more calves are expected to join the growing camel herd soon. There are also 4 baby lambs born recently at the ranch from a flock of miniature baby doll Southdown sheep. You can come see some of the new arrivals, along with other animals, at the Oasis Camel Dairy's upcoming open farm tour and show on Valentine's weekend, February 13th and 14th. The event features a show with camels, exotic birds, and other animals. There will also be camel rides for kids, as well as a shop filled with goods, such as camel hair scarves, camel milk lotions, soaps and fragrances such as pomegranate, citrus, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. To learn more about this one-of-a-kind East County attraction, you can visit CamelDairy.com. This has been Leon Thompson for East County Magazine.
Teams are hitting the streets today, gathering signatures for a ballot measure this fall that would extend part of Proposition 30, which raised income taxes on the wealthy and raised the sales tax by 0.25%, then funneled the money to public education. The sales tax expires at the end of this year, and the income tax is supposed to be phased out in 2018. Joshua Peschtalt with the California Federation of Teachers says the sales tax increase would not be renewed, which is a big change from the prior version.
The Prop 30 extension would ask individuals making over $250,000 a year to continue to pay a little bit more in personal income tax. This would eliminate the bump up in sales tax.
Prop 30 has raised about $6 billion a year so far. This new measure would extend the taxes on the well-to-do for another dozen years. Peschtalt says Prop 30 money has allowed many schools to lower class sizes, restore counseling positions, bring back extracurricular activities, and begin to recover from the devastating cuts made 8 years ago.
While it hasn't made up for all of the cuts that were made during the Great Recession, it's gone a long way to improving public education in California. It's also resulted in our community colleges being able to restore classes.
While signature gathering begins today, the official announcement of the ballot measure will be rolled out on Wednesday. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine, and my special guest today, and one of my favorite people, is Nori Robbins, who was just inducted into the International Educators Hall of Fame. Can you imagine that? Nori is a biogeologist and worked with the U.S. Geological Survey and was in the Peace Corps, and she taught outdoor science, as she calls it, to inner-city kids in Washington, D.C. And since she's retired in 2001, here in San Diego, she's been teaching science, outdoor science, to children on the Indian reservations here in San Diego. We had a nice long conversation, and here's part of our conversation about San Diego rivers and reservations. You know what I really enjoyed about your lecture was the three rivers.
Ah.
The San Luis Rey.
Uh-huh.
The San Diego, and then the southern,
Sweetwater.
Sweetwater.
Uh-huh.
Which goes into Mexico, right?
Uh-huh, and the Tijuana, uh-huh.
So basically there's three groups, essentially.
Exactly. The rivers defined the territories of the people. So the Kumeyaay had the San Diego River, and the Luceño had the San Luis Rey River, and the Cupeño had Warner Springs, and the Kahuilla were in the desert. Different, but then what would happen is people would separate out and then go along the other rivers. You know, it's an interesting question that you're asking. Those three rivers must have been the rivers that had water all year round.
Because the San Luis Rey River was diverted for agricultural purposes.
Well, it went into Lake Henshaw, right. So all the upper elevation tributaries all flow into Lake Henshaw,
right.
And then Henshaw. And then, of course, you had Henry Rodriguez and his buddies at the La Jolla Reservation that realized that there were treaty rights that said that their reservations were going to have so many acre feet of water, and they weren't getting it, and they fought it to the Supreme Court and won. And so Lake Henshaw has to release certain amount of acre feet of water to the La Jolla Reservation, but the other reservations downstream didn't fight back in the same way. And so as soon as it leaves the La Jolla Reservation, that water goes into a pipe and it gets taken to Oceanside.
Oh, my. So then the Paulas and the
right.
Palmas and the Rincons are downstream.
Right.
And they don't get the water that they traditionally did. At one time, there was a flowing river.
I'm working on the San Diego River right now, and there were so many village sites along the San Diego River, it must have been a perennial river. When I got here and started Science Explorers Club, I started with Henry Rodriguez, and I told him I wanted to teach outdoor science to kids on reservations to raise them up to be scientists, and he said, and you want them to be hydrologists, because if you're an Indian, you've got to pay attention to your water quantity and your water quality. And on his reservation, there is water. On the La Jolla Reservation, there is water. And so I thought that was really simple. You know, we'll take the kids into the water, get them wet and dirty, and, you know, they'll turn into hydrologists all by themselves. But then it turned out that that's the only reservation with water in San Diego County. The Mesa Grande Reservation has water during part of the year. And so those kids go into the water. But none of the other reservations. When I went to Campo and I said, I want to get the kids wet and dirty, the education director there, she said to me, well, you won't have any trouble getting them dirty. She said, well, we have a hose. And so they have a hose. But then they had one of the guys who came back, an engineer who came back to the reservation, and he started looking into the ancient way of keeping water on the land. And he worked out the technique that was called rock drop structures. And he built a rock drop structure on the Campo Reservation. And now they have water all the time in a pond. And that water flows a little bit out of the pond. And he got an EPA award for this. And then the next one he built was in Tecate. So the people there have water all year round also.
So what's it like?
Which the rock drop, the pond,
the
pond
drop.
Is we take the kids to the pond, particularly this month is a World Water Monitoring Day. So I'm teaching all the kids on the six reservations. You know, we're looking at the water. We're testing the water, whether it's the hose or it's the pump, you know, the hose, the pump, the pond or the river, depending upon which reservation I'm at. And so it's very interesting with the kids. This is November, okay? So November, it's getting cool here in San Diego County. And so I take the kids to the pond, test the water, do the pH and the oxygen. And it isn't too long before one kid jumps in and then the next kid jumps in and then all the kids jump into the water. So that's what it is when you have water. The kids at La Jolla do the same thing, you know. You get them to the water to test the water, and it isn't too long before.
Next thing you know.
Jump in the water, and then we jump in the water.
Acting like kids.
Yeah, they're kids. That's right. That's what water is for.
Becoming hydrologists.
That's right, to become hydrologists. The issue is, you know, my dad did that with me, too. He took us to the creek in front of our house that was near our house, and we walked in the creek, and he was a physicist, right? So we were talking about energy transfer from the noise coming from the chemical changes in the water and the noise and the mechanical energy, and that's what he talked about. But I was picking fossils, and I was having fun with fossils in the creek. So Henry said, turn these kids into hydrologists. But then I met the environmental director at the Pala Reservation, and she said, you know, when I retire or when I leave here, we need the next generation to step up. You know, the Pala people need a Pala person to be the environmental director. And she says, I need those kids to start thinking about that. On the La Jolla Reservation, I'm talking hydrology all the time. On the Pala Reservation, I'm talking environmental director, the environmental issues. And on the Pala Reservation, they have, you know, Gregory Mountain Landfill that we're always fighting against. There's those people that were tied to the political system in San Diego that are talking about putting a dump on the sacred mountain of the Luseno people, yeah. Gregory Mountain, Tuckwick. So that's a giant environmental issue that's going on with the Luseno people along the San Luis Rey River.
Yes. You ever find artifacts?
So only on the Barona Reservation, and then we do that with the archaeologists there, with the Barona Museum people, mm-hmm. and then if the kids find artifacts, then the archaeologist explains what this is, and then to always put it back where you found it.
Oh.
And so the kids, that's what I teach the kids. I teach the way the Barona people taught me. You find something and you can discuss it, and then you put it back exactly where you found it.
Do you find shards and pottery?
Yes, they're at Barona, because people have been there for a really long time. And also along El Capitan Reservoir, where the villages were, you find pottery. You know, you would think I would find pottery at Campo because there was a village there, but we found pottery, a really beautiful piece, and I handed it to one of the kids who didn't understand the importance of what it was that I gave him, and it wasn't too long until it was broken pieces.
Oh, no.
So I have to learn. I do not know everything. So you don't give a boy a piece of pottery.
Rule number one.
Rule number one.
That was educator and biogeologist Nori Robbins. Stay tuned for more conversations with Nori in coming weeks here on East County Magazine.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing New York Times bestselling author Caitlin Rother about the release of her new true crime thriller, The No One Can Have Her. I last interviewed Caitlin Rother after the publication of Lost Girls, which was her 8th book and 6th true crime. Then No One Can Have Her is her 10th book. Welcome, Caitlin. It's a pleasure having you again on Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Let's start with your new book, The No One Can Have Her. Tell us what drew you to this case, to the life and murder of Carol Kennedy, who was an artist, therapist, and mother of two.
I actually came to this case through a reader of one of my former books.
Oh, really?
Who lived in Prescott, Arizona, and had read Dead Reckoning, which was a story about two other murder victims from Prescott, Arizona. She started sending me news articles. And by the time the second trial in this case was almost through, I finally had time to sit down and read the news articles. And as I went through them, I thought, wow, this is a curious, bizarre kind of case, even just within reading about three articles. So I went back and I read 5 years worth of news articles, because this case took 5 years to get from arrest to sentencing, two trials, a whole series of judges, a whole second set of charges filed against Steve DeMocker, who was already in jail awaiting trial on murder. So Carol Kennedy actually did not play a huge part in my initial draw to this case. But then once I got to know her, meaning, you know, saw her picture, started learning about her, started interviewing her close friends and her family, I came to discover that, you know, she was a really beautiful person, very spiritual, very gentle. She was an artist and a therapist and a loving mother of two. She had stuck in this marriage for 25 years trying to make it work while her husband, Steve, continued to have affairs. And she said, you know, you have a sex addiction. I think you really need to get treated for it. And she stuck with him because as a therapist, she wanted to be there for him when he came out on the other side.
Right.
Except he didn't.
Okay. So reading about it, you really do become, I guess, close to the victim.
Well, I saw her picture and I just thought, wow, she's really pretty. She was a former model when she was a teenager. She had been in magazines and traveled around. But she was just a good person. You could see it in her face. And, you know, her students saw her as a guru. She taught yoga, psychology, and dream work. And so she just seemed like she was just a very, very much in touch with her spiritual side. Mm-hmm. And as an artist, you know, she was apparently very prolific. And her art had these beautiful figures that were, you know, angels and floating up. And, you know, it just really, I was drawn to her, spirit, and the fact that she was treating domestic violence victims and ironically became one herself, I thought was just one of the biggest tragedies in this whole case.
Yeah, it shows you how you can't necessarily prevent something, even if you understand it.
Yeah, and one of the things that really did draw me to this case is at the very essence of it, it is a domestic violence case, but it's very, you know, different to me because it was such a multi-layered and textured case with so many other issues going on. But at its heart, it is about a love gone wrong between these two people. Carol and Steve, I think, really did try to make this marriage work. Carol much more than Steve. Unfortunately.
So is that what you meant when you call the case messy and complicated? What did you mean by that comment?
Well, the case had many mistakes along the way in terms of the investigation, but Steve also complicated things as well by continuing to do things from behind bars, drawing his daughters and his mother and, you know, family into a series of these schemes where he's moving Carol's insurance money that was supposed to go to his daughters. He persuaded his older daughter to pay it to his mother, to pay it to his defense attorneys, who then later in the middle of the first trial had to withdraw from a conflict of interest entirely of Steve's making, wasted all of the daughter's inheritance, had to start completely over at the taxpayer's expense to hire a new defense team and start all over with new charges based on what he had been doing from behind bars in addition to the murder. On the prosecution side, there were mistakes made by the medical examiner, for example.
Really?
So a year and a half, the investigators for the prosecution were looking for this mystery man whose DNA was underneath Carol's fingernails. So they tested everybody and their brother who had ever been anywhere near Carol or her house, only to come to find out a year and a half later that it was the guy who had the autopsy right before Carol.
Oh. Wow.
Right. So when I say messy, that's just sort of gives you a little bit of a flavor of it.
And I know that you said that the story to you also speaks to the dangers of online dating. What would you say about that?
Well, Steve DeMocker, because he was a sex and love addict, not only, you know, Carol was never good enough for him. Just Carol. So he was always having an affair on the side. And at times he apparently was having multiple affairs. Once he was separated, he was seeing several women at once. They all thought they were the only ones. He was on at least two dating websites that we know of, Great Expectations and AdultFriendFinder.com. And he, on one page, would say he was separated. On another page, would say he was divorced. I don't know what he told these women, but I know there was at least one complaint from someone who said, you know, he told me he was separated. He told me he was divorced, but he's not even, you know, he's not divorced. He's seeing me, seeing other people. He was having a relationship with a woman who apparently thought she was having a monogamous relationship with him. And this is on the sex hookup site, so I don't know what that says about that woman, but I don't know how many there were, but he was flying around spending money that he wasn't earning and got into all kinds of debt. So these women who thought they were meeting this Steve DeMocker investment broker were not getting what they thought they were getting. Carol was also doing online dating, and so was her guest tenant, and I think she was the only one who was probably truthful in what she presented herself as.
Yeah, it really speaks to how we can hide behind the computer.
Exactly.
Behind the internet. And also, it speaks to how manipulative and narcissistic this person is.
Yes, Steve was very manipulative, and it just amazed me how he was able to talk his daughters into turning against their mother, you know, the younger daughter especially. Mm-hmm. By saying, you know, your mother is not agreeing to these settlement agreements I'm putting forth in the divorce. Mm-hmm. It's dragging out. It's all her fault. Mm-hmm. And he kept writing these emails to Carol as well, when in fact he was the one who was overspending to the tune of at least $1 million in debt, earning, you know, a good living as an investment broker, but spending far more than he was earning, borrowing money from his elderly parents, borrowing against his kids' savings accounts and, you know, loans that he got from work. you know, blaming Carol when she was earning only $24,000 a year. And he even made her lose her job at the art gallery because he kept coming in and having arguments with her, and they had to let her go because she was just too distracted. So all around, Steve was all about Steve.
Well, how do you, as the writer, get into the mindset of someone like that? Do you do extra research on, say, sex addiction, sociopathic mindset? How do you really try to get your mind around somebody who's so difficult to understand for most people?
Well, a case like this is really not any different from any other case that I research in terms of my approach. And that is that I come to a case like this, I try to have as open mind as possible. And I just basically want to find the truth, no matter where that's going to lead me. So I start out by going through, you know, I listen to his own words. I listen to the recordings of the interrogations with the detectives, you know, right away. I listen to the recorded jail calls where he's, you know, persuading his daughter to give her inheritance over to his mother and defense attorneys. I listen to how he talks to his girlfriend in jail. I mean, I listen to him. I also read all the investigative reports of all the other witness interviews of all the women who had been involved with him. I start getting a picture. I read the emails between him and Carol back and forth and how he's blaming her for going into debt when it's, you know, I have his bank accounts and I'm looking. So basically I'm gathering an enormous picture. I start interviewing people who knew both of them. I get to the bottom of the dynamic between the two of them. So I start to get a picture. I also really tried to interview him, to interview his family, to interview his defense attorneys so I could get his side of the story straight from him. But he chose not to talk to me, so I rely on what other people have to say about him and, you know, what words he said for himself. And I let the reader really draw their own conclusion because I don't put my own opinion in there. But I basically just lay it all out. And, you know, his words really do speak loudly. His own words are somewhat damning. Himself. Yes.
It sounds like a jigsaw puzzle in a way, putting all the pieces together.
Yeah, I mean, it's really like connect the dots. And my job, that as I see it, is to get into the psychology behind cases like this. So what could have motivated him to do what a jury convicted him of doing?
Right. Is it emotionally draining for you at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. It is. You know, I have a love for what I do, but I also have to be honest that it does get very dark and it does get incredibly exhausting because I have great need to have integrity in my process and a great accuracy. So, it was particularly challenging in this case because I had to go through so many hundreds and thousands of pages of documentation to create this story because the sheriff's office, the county attorney's office, the prosecution and the defense attorneys, they just didn't want to talk because, like I said, this case was such a mess from the beginning and they're very concerned with having it overturned on appeal after it went through two trials, series of judges, two different prosecution teams, two different defense teams. And there were, you know, multiple people who came in and out of those chairs. So a lot of ethical allegations going back and forth. It really was a mess.
Do you typically, for your books in general, do you typically travel a lot in doing your research or do you do it based in your home? How do you really get to the source of everything?
Well, I was very grateful in this case to be able to have so much of it online and sent to me as public records, which I requested repeatedly.
Right.
So I did go to Prescott. I did tour the area. I did go to the courthouse. I did bring my copy machine and my camera, and I took lots of pictures and collected lots of information. But I then had a series of discs that were sent to me. I had all the trial transcripts. I had all the photos, the exhibits, et cetera. And I read, you know, as much as I possibly could absorb. And then I sort of pulled the story together from that and my own interviews.
That's a lot of hard work.
It is a lot of hard work. So you can see why it's exhausting. But I do enjoy it. And I do feel it's very rewarding to be able to create a lasting tribute and memory to a murder victim like Carol, who did seem to live such a such a good life. And she really did not, you wouldn't expect someone like her to be in a situation where she would get murdered. That was part of also what drew me to this case. Mm-hmm. She was such a sympathetic victim.
So in a sense, you feel like you're giving back to the victim through working
yes,
on this.
Absolutely. And, you know, like I said, she was a therapist that worked with battered women and domestic violence victims. And it's just so ironic that she ended up taking so long to recognize that she was in such an unhealthy situation. She did get out of it. And the sad thing is Steve just would not let her go. And that's where the title comes from.
And possibly other people could learn from it and see their own situation.
And that is my hope. That is absolutely my hope, that other women who are in the same situation can read my book, recognize something similar, and get out before
right.
it's too late.
Right. You're a Pulitzer-nominated investigative journalist, and you worked for 20 years for daily newspapers. Have you ever rethought your decision to go into true crime as a writer, or is it something that you feel that you're satisfied with the journey that you've had?
Well, as a reporter, most recently as at the Union Tribune, I covered government and politics, and
that could be dark too.
It just got kind of old to be spun all the time.
Uh-huh.
And I did, you know, I always enjoyed reading about crime stories, but I really feel like I've been able to draw from a lot of my newspaper journalism experience covering mental illness, covering addiction, covering jails and prisons, covering government, and also doing some criminal justice. I covered the Kristen Rossum case when I was still at the paper, and that was what my first book, Poisoned Love, was based on. And I've taken that, and I've basically pulled from that experience and built on it to tell stories with narrative nonfiction, looking also for flaws in our criminal justice system. So, I mean, true crime, I think, is kind of a narrow genre way to look at this type of story, but I feel like, you know, I broaden it to more of a mainstream audience, looking where the investigations were flawed, looking where our criminal justice system and legal system may have been flawed. In my book, Lost Girls, I also looked at the mental health, corrections, parole systems that fell down and let out a sexual offender like John Gardner out on the street in order to kill two teenage girls, Chelsea King and Amber Dubois. So I try to go beyond the basic murder. I also look at the system, and I really just try to find out the truth, and whatever it is, I lay it out there.
So we could say that in a way that it's holding society accountable as well.
I would like to say so, yes.
I know that you teach narrative nonfiction and author branding at San Diego Writers, Inc. and UCSD Extension. Do you have any advice for writers out there who would like to write this type of book?
Well, the keys to getting published, at least for me, were patience, determination, and the ability to repeatedly rebound from rejection.
Okay.
Because that's what it takes. You got to have a tough skin, and you really need to work at your craft, and you just need to keep at it. And I'm still growing, I think, as a writer, as an author, as a storyteller, as an investigator. I think you can grow until you die.
Yes.
And keep trying to be better, always.
And so you keep trying to improve as well, staying involved with the writing community.
Yes. And I work as a writing coach also, and a book doctor, and also as a writing and research consultant. And I really do enjoy helping aspiring authors pursue their dream just like I did. I mean, it's fun for me. You know, it's rewarding when I give them advice and I see a little bell go off, you know, and their eyes light up. And I enjoy working with young people and with older people too, who are trying to publish their first book. I mean, I would, anyone who wants to do that and really has the guts and the persistence, I'd like to help them get there.
Great. So, one last question. What are you writing next? Or now? What are you writing now?
Well, I'm actually working on some compilations of shorter crime cases because the books, as we talked about, are kind of exhausting to do.
Right.
But I am following the McStay case. And I'm looking at a number of other cases where I may not do a full big-length book, but some maybe shorter books online.
And when should we expect to see that? Do you have an idea?
I have a compilation of South Carolina cases, which, you know, a couple historic cases and one other, which should be hitting the market sometime soon. It's called A Complicated Woman.
Oh, good title. Well, that's all we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you so much for having me back. I really appreciate it.
For more information on Caitlin Rother and her work, please visit her website at caitlinrother.com, and that's spelled CAITLINROTHER. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you've been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is Richard Faust with a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. If you're revved up to get a car, truck, or other vehicle, bidding for the county's latest online public vehicle auction opens Monday, February 8th. You can check out what's available before these steals on wheels are gone. Surplus vehicles include automobiles, trucks, vans, SUVs, trailers, a Prius hybrid, a school bus, and even an ambulance. The surplus government property comes from the county and other local agencies, and many bids start at only $100. If you'd like to check out the vehicles in person, they'll go on display on Saturday, February 13th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and again on Monday, February 15th from 8 a.m. to noon at 369 Main Street in Ramona. You can register to bid for the auction online anytime from February 8th until the bidding ends on the following Monday, February 15th. For more information, for a catalog and photos of many of the items up for auction, visit the County News Center or check the news section, eastcountymagazine.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
Environmental groups are breathing a sigh of relief after the U.S. Senate defeated an attack on the president's ability to declare national monuments by executive order. On Tuesday, lawmakers killed an amendment to the Senate energy bill. It would have modified the Antiquities Act to make all presidential national monument designations temporary for 3 years and subject to approval by Congress and the relevant state legislature. David Myers with the Wildlands Conservancy says if ultimately passed, the change would have effectively blocked most new national monuments.
I think it was a real vote for reason that the majority of the United States Senate believes in the value of our public land, the ability of the president to set aside these unblemished landscapes for perpetuity when it's the only way to get it done.
Conservation groups have urged President Obama to declare 3 national monuments in the Southern California desert, called Mojave Trails, Sand to Snow, and Castle Mountains. Myers notes that Senator Dianne Feinstein's bill to create the monuments has stalled.
The senator tried for 6 years to get legislation passed, but it had no chance in passing through a Republican-led Congress.
The Antiquities Act has been used equally by Democrats and Republicans since its inception in 1906 under Teddy Roosevelt. The Grand Canyon, Joshua Tree National Park, and Grand Teton National Park all started out as national monuments declared under the Antiquities Act. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.